I want you to imagine holding this tiny, like thumb-sized piece of dried clay in the palm of your hand.
Just a really small, unassuming object.
Yeah, exactly. It's chalky, perhaps a little uneven around the edges, and it smells faintly of like ancient pollen and burnt ash.
Right.
Now, I want you to imagine that this tiny piece of clay is encased in a custom-made, meticulously engineered, solid gold housing.
Which is an incredible visual contrast,
It really is.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to buy it today, you couldn't just walk into a store. You'd be scouring these highly specialized global collector networks, wiring anywhere from like $2,000 to $3,000, and waiting for an armed FedEx delivery just to hold it.
And honestly, you'd probably find that most of the highly sought-after variants are simply listed as out of stock, regardless of the price you're willing to pay.
Which is just wild to
Oh,
me.
absolutely.
Because usually when we talk about a billion-dollar collector's market with that kind of exclusivity, we're talking about, master horologists in Switzerland crafting luxury watches or rare meteorites or like massive diamonds pulled from the earth.
Yeah, we expect the origin story of the object to be absolutely dripping with wealth and exclusivity.
Right. We expect the creator to be someone obsessed with material
And
perfection.
high society commerce, right?
Exactly. But today, you and we are diving into a market that completely shatters that expectation. Because the foundation of this global frenzy, the reason these specific objects are so fiercely hunted by collectors, is a man who lived a life of absolute grinding, extreme poverty.
Yeah, the contrast is what
Yeah.
makes this entire study so deeply fascinating.
So today, our mission for this deep dive is to unpack this massive collection of historical texts, collector archives, and photographic records centered on Thai Buddhist history. We are exploring the life, the legacy, and the incredibly complex sacred artifacts of Luang Phuthu, the revered abbot of Wat Purdue Chimpli.
Because you have this modern hyper-capitalist reality of online catalogs, certificates of authenticity, and forensic authentication of amulets like the Prapid Tom Maha Lap Jumbo 2 or the Plod Knee.
Right.
And then on the flip side, you have the source of all this value, an orphan boy born in 1887 in rural Siam who took strict vows of poverty, lived in mosquito-infested forests, and actively tried to extinguish his own ego.
So we're taking you on a journey today from those quiet, dangerous forest paths of early 20th century Siam, all the way to the meticulous, magnifying glass-wielding forensic world of modern amulet authentication.
It's quite a leap.
It is, because we really need to figure out why the character of this one specific monk remains the true source of these objects' power, and why a piece of clay he pressed with his thumb over a century ago is now worth more than its weight in gold.
Well, to understand the clay, you really have to understand the man who pressed it.
Right. Where do we start?
We have to go back to March 27, 1887, to a small agricultural community called Ban Klong Bang Noi,
Right.
which is in the Samut Songkhram province. His parents, Mr. Loy and Mrs. Thap, were just ordinary villagers. But he was orphaned at a very young age.
And I think we need to pause there.
Yeah.
Because if you're listening to this today, the concept of being orphaned is obviously tragic, but we assume there are state mechanisms, right?
Like foster care.
Exactly. Foster care, some kind of social safety net. But in rural Siam in the late 19th century, being an orphan wasn't just sad, it was a matter of sheer survival.
Oh, absolutely.
You were entirely unmoored in an agrarian society that literally relied on family labor to eat.
You had nothing. But the saving grace of Thai society at the time, the absolute bedrock of the social structure, was the local temple.
Because it wasn't just a church.
No, not at all. The temple wasn't just a place for Sunday worship. It functioned as the hospital, the local government outreach, the community center, and crucially for him, the orphanage and primary school.
Wow.
So he was taken in by a local monk named Luang Tekoh.
And the sources emphasize that this wasn't just a charity case, right? Luang Chikema must have seen something specific in this kid.
Yeah, he saw an intense seriousness. The historical records point out that even as a young boy, he was unusually intelligent and possessed a very calm, disciplined character.
Which is pretty rare for a child.
Very rare. So Luang Takhaue recognized that this boy had a ceiling that was much higher than what a small village temple could offer him. To ensure he got a proper education, he eventually moved the boy to a major institution in Bangkok Wat Purdue Chimpli.
And that move to Bangkok is the pivot point, really.
It changes everything.
He enters the monkhood as a novice at just 17 years old. And what stands out here in the texts is the sheer level of dedication. In Thailand, then and now, entering the monkhood temporarily is a very common rite of passage for young men.
Right, it's almost like a spiritual summer camp.
Yeah, exactly. A summer camp before you go off to get married or start a career. You ordain for a few weeks or maybe months to make merit for your parents. But he wasn't doing a summer camp.
No, he was fully committing his entire life to the discipline. By the time he turns 20, on July 16, 1907, he receives his higher ordination as a bhikkhu.
Which is a fully ordained monk.
Right, and he is given the monastic name Intisuwano. His approach to the monastic life was incredibly holistic from the start. He didn't just want to read the ancient Pali scriptures and become an academic, but he also didn't want to just sit in a cave and ignore the texts entirely.
He wanted both.
Yes, he believed in dual cultivation. He dove into heavy scriptural study, but paired it immediately with rigorous, practical meditation training.
Which accelerates his rise through the ranks at a terrifying speed. Because at the age of 26, he is appointed the abbot of Wat Purdue Chimpli.
Which is just staggering.
Right. I really want to pause on that because the title abbot sounds very serene and, I don't know, ceremonial. But let's frame what that actually means in reality.
It is the furthest thing from a ceremonial title.
So imagine a 26-year-old kid today, someone who just finished their master's degree. Now imagine handing them the keys to a massive, deeply historical university in the middle of a bustling metropolis. And you tell them, okay, you're not just teaching a class, you have to manage the faculty of older, tenured professors. You have to balance the massive budget.
Oversee construction.
Right. You have to oversee the construction of new campus buildings. You have to negotiate with the city council for land rights. And on top of all that, you have to act as the flawless moral compass for thousands of students.
That is exactly the administrative and spiritual weight placed on a 26-year-old abbot in Bangkok.
It's just unbelievable.
And remember the cultural context of age in Asian societies.
Yeah.
Age is highly synonymous with authority.
Oh, for sure.
So for a 26-year-old to manage the discipline of resident monks who are in their 50s and 60s, that requires profound emotional intelligence. You can't just mandate respect from your elders.
You have to undeniably earn it every single day.
Exactly. He had to resolve community disputes, manage the spiritual welfare of thousands of lay people who came to the temple daily, and oversee the physical expansion of Wat Purdue Chimpli.
So how does he do it? Like, how does he avoid being eaten alive by the politics and the pressure of all that?
Well, according to the records, by radical humility. The moment he became abbot, he didn't suddenly act like he had all the answers. The records show he actively sought out older, accomplished masters for instruction.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, he traveled to study under highly regarded monks, like Luang Phorung of Wat Thai Krabu. He leveraged his position not to command people, but to learn faster.
Which introduces the practice of Tudong into his life. And Tudong is something we really need to unpack for you listening, because it sounds like a peaceful hike in the woods, but the reality is staggering.
Tudong is the ascetic forest wandering tradition, and it is the ultimate test of a monk's discipline.
How so?
Well, you leave the relative comfort of a Bangkok temple, you take only your robes, an alms bowl, and an umbrella tent, and you walk deep into the ancient, untamed forests of Siam.
Just walking into the jungle.
Exactly. Lung Phu Tu spent years doing this, often traveling alongside another legendary figure, Luang Por Sod of Wat Phak Nam.
Okay, I have to push back on the timeline here, or at least how we perceive it.
Sure.
Because we just established that he is the incredibly busy administrative CEO of a major Bangkok temple, right? Mm-hmm. He's counseling villagers, he's dealing with marriages, funerals, community crises. His reputation is growing so much that he eventually receives the royal title Paracha Samwarapimandana and is participating in highly exclusive royal initiation ceremonies.
Yes, all of that is happening.
So how does a monk balance the intense, silent, solitary isolation of the Tudong forest with being the ultimate public spiritual anchor for a bustling metropolis? To a modern ear, those are mutually exclusive lives.
In a Western framework, they absolutely are mutually exclusive. We tend to separate the contemplative life from the active life.
Yeah.
You are either a silent hermit meditating on a mountain, or you are a social worker dealing with the chaos of the city.
Right, you can't be both.
But the Thai Buddhist philosophy operates on a completely different mechanic. The isolation in the forest is the very fuel for the community work in the city.
Explain that mechanic. How does wandering in a remote jungle help a villager back in Bangkok?
It comes down to the concept of accumulated spiritual virtue, or merit. When a monk engages in Tudong, he is facing extreme physical and psychological hardship. We are talking about deep jungles filled with tigers, venomous snakes, and incredibly high rates of malaria.
It's basically a survival situation.
It is. The monk has to face down his own primal fear of death, his hunger, and his bodily discomfort, relying entirely on his meditative discipline to survive. The belief is that by enduring this with pure intentions and strict adherence to monastic vows, the monk accumulates a tangible, powerful spiritual energy.
Oh, I see. It's kind of like a spiritual battery. And the forest is the extreme environment where the battery is charged.
Precisely. That's a great way to put it. The harder the environment, the deeper the meditation required, and the greater the charge. So when Wang Futuo returns to Bangkok and a villager comes to him in crisis, maybe their child is sick or their harvest failed, and he gives them a blessing, that blessing isn't just empty words.
It carries weight.
Yes. The devotee believes that the blessing carries the weight and the protective power of those terrifying malaria-filled nights in the jungle. His ability to help the community was directly proportional to his willingness to suffer in the forest.
That is a phenomenal way to understand it. His reputation wasn't built on like flashy miracles or PR stunts. It was built on decades of highly visible, unwavering discipline.
Absolutely.
And that intense devotion from the community, that absolute belief in the sheer density of his spiritual virtue, creates a very human logistical problem, doesn't it?
The problem of scale.
Exactly, because you have thousands of people who want a piece of that virtue. They want a physical reminder of his presence, especially when they are out working the fields or traveling, and they can't just walk into Wat Purdue Chimpli to see him.
Right, you can't be everywhere at once.
And long before we get to the complex alchemical clay amulets, this desire manifests in something very simple and modern photography.
Yes, the early devotional items were formal portrait lockets. The archives extensively document pieces like the 2519 BE Blueface Chukfi lockets.
What do those look like?
They were basically small framed photographs of Luang Fu that devotees could pin to their shirts or wear around their necks.
But think about what a photograph represents. It's highly personal. It is a literal image of the man. A devotee wears it to remember his specific face, his specific voice, and his personal teachings, you know?
It's a token of a relationship.
Exactly. But in 2463 BE, which is the year 1920 in the Western calendar, there's a massive philosophical and physical shift. He releases his first edition of amulets directly made by his own hands, the famous 13 Pim.
And this is where the history stops being just a biography and turns into art history and esoteric science.
Yeah, it gets really technical.
It does. So Pim refers to the specific mold used to shape the amulet. In this massive 1920 effort, he utilized 13 distinct molds to press these clay and powder tablets.
Now, assuming you, our listener, are familiar with the general landscape of Thai amulets, you probably know the basic Somdez shape. It's the classic rectangular tablet featuring a seated Buddha in meditation.
Very iconic.
But the archives highlight specific Pim from this 1920 batch that collectors absolutely obsess over today. There's the Pra Somdez Samcham Pim Kato, which is the three-tiered dais known as the table leg model. There's the Jet Chan, which is the seven-tiered dais, and the Hubei Shri, the long-eared version.
We should decode the iconography here because these aren't just aesthetic design choices.
Let's do it.
Let's take the Jet Chan, the seven-tiered base. In Buddhist cosmology, the number seven is highly significant. It often represents the seven factors of enlightenment, or the 7 days the Buddha spent meditating after achieving awakening. The base elevates the Buddha, separating the enlightened state from the mundane world.
Okay, that makes sense. And what about the Hubei Shri? Why specifically highlight the long ears of the Buddha?
Ah, the elongated earlobes are a classic sign of a great being, or a Mahaparisa. Historically, it references Prince Siddhartha's early life of immense wealth. He wore these heavy, solid gold earrings that physically stretched his lobes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and when he renounced his wealth to seek enlightenment, he took the jewelry out, but the stretched lobes remained. So an amulet emphasizing the long ears is a constant visual reminder of renunciation, of giving up worldly attachments to find true peace.
That's beautiful.
It also symbolizes an ultimate compassionate ability to hear the cries and suffering of the world.
So literally every millimeter of these molds is preaching a sermon. But the shift from a photographic locket of his own face to a clay image of the Buddha is profound to me. He's removing his own identity from the object entirely. He is telling his followers, "Don't cling to me, the man. Cling to the Buddha, the ultimate symbol of enlightenment." He's transferring his blessing into a universal lineage.
That is the exact intention. The texts emphasize that he undertook the creation of these 13 Pym with the purest intention. This wasn't merchandise sold at a gift shop.
Right.
It was an intent spiritual effort to create objects of genuine protective power for his community. And the sheer physical labor involved is staggering.
Most of these were pressed by his own hands, right? Imagine the physical toll. You have dense, heavy, damp clay. You have to force it into a carved block, apply immense pressure to capture the fine details of the table leg or the long ears, carefully extract it without ruining the edge, and then set it to dry.
It's exhausting work.
Doing that 10 times is hard. Doing it thousands of times is an act of extreme physical endurance.
Well, he did have assistance with the menial assembly tasks. The novice monks, the samaneras, helped, alongside the laymasters of a neighboring temple, Wat Pleb.
And that mention of Wat Pleb is the thread that unravels the deepest mystery of these objects.
It really is.
Because the shape of the amulet, the beautiful iconography we just discussed, is merely the shell.
Right. The true power, the reason a modern collector will pay thousands of dollars for the 1920 Kato print today, isn't because it looks pretty. It's because of the microscopic, invisible ingredients mixed into the clay itself.
So we need to talk about the absolute secrecy and the heavy science of Muon Sarn.
Yes. Muon Sarn translates to the sacred powder compound. If the mold, the Pym, is the body of the amulet, the Muon Sarn is the genetic code.
I love that.
It is a highly complex alchemical compound made of the rarest herbs, specific types of woods, and profound relic ingredients.
The texts specifically refer to Pong Wised or Pong Puchakun. What is the actual chemistry of these powders?
This is where those terrifying years in the Tudong forest bear physical fruit. While Luang Futo was wandering through those remote ancient jungles, he was constantly collecting.
Collecting what?
He was gathering specific rare pollens from deep forest flowers that bloom rarely. He was scraping earth from the floors of sacred meditation caves. He was collecting natural saps and resins. These organic materials were hoarded over decades.
Let me use an analogy here to ground this for you because it can sound a bit like a fantasy novel. Think about a master artisan baker who maintains a sourdough starter that is a century old.
That's a great comparison.
Right. That starter isn't just flour and water, it's alive. It has captured the wild ambient yeast from the air of every single bakery it has ever sat in. It contains the living environment, the microbial history, the literal DNA of every geographic location the baker has traveled to, and the influence of every master baker who ever folded something new into it.
Exactly.
When you eat bread baked from that starter, you are physically consuming history. Muon Sarn is essentially a spiritual sourdough starter.
I love that analogy because it perfectly captures the compounding nature of the material. It is a tactile, physical record of his spiritual journey. Every grain of pollen in that clay represents a specific forest he survived, a specific state of deep meditation he achieved in a cave, or a specific secret passed down to him.
And the secrets passed down to him are critical because the archives note that the great masters of Wat Pleb shared their inner secrets of mixing Muon Sarn with him. Wat Pleb wasn't just a regular temple, was it?
No, Wat Pleb was effectively the Ivy League institution for esoteric and magical knowledge, known as Wicha in Thailand at the time.
Wow.
Masters of immense capability passed through there, and they taught Luang Phu to the mastery of Prap Pitiha.
Which is the control of the five Pitishanas. For those unfamiliar, jhanas are states of profound, absorbing, meditative rapture. But, and this is the big question, how does a monk take a mental state of rapture and put it into a physical piece of clay?
Through an incredibly demanding process called Pong Lob making. This is where the alchemy reaches its absolute peak.
How does it work?
A monk doesn't just mix dirt in a bowl. He creates chalk from sacred materials. Then, entering into a deep meditative state, specifically controlling those Pitishanas you mentioned, he uses the chalk to draw complex sacred geometric diagrams and incantations, called yantras, onto a slate board.
So he writes out the magical formula?
Yes. But the writing isn't the final product.
Wait, what?
Once the intricate diagram is complete and infused with his meditative focus, he sweeps the chalk dust off the board and collects it.
He erases it.
Yes. Then he forms the dust back into chalk, enters a deeper meditative state, and draws an even more complex yantra. He erases it, collects the dust, and repeats the process over and over and over, sometimes for months.
That is mind-blowing.
The final, incredibly fine concentrated dust left over is the Pong Puttikun. It is the physical residue of thousands of hours of concentrated meditative rapture.
And the specific formulas he used for this. The archives tie this back to the legendary Datamra, or textbook, of Ajarn Seng. The story goes that Ajarn Seng found these ancient alchemical instructions hidden inside a Hinsila stone.
Whether you view the hidden stone as literal history or a mythological framing, the lineage of the knowledge is undeniable. When Luang Futu sat down in 1920 to press those amulets, he was mixing decades of his own forest-gathered pollens with heavily guarded, deeply concentrated alchemical powders passed down from generations of Wat Plab masters.
Which brings us crashing into the modern day. Because these amulets are filled with this incredibly complex organic matter, and because their history is so rich, the demand for them is just astronomical.
It's massive.
And where there is massive financial demand, there is forgery. Authenticating these amulets today has become a meticulous, obsessive forensic science.
The modern collector's eye is a discipline unto itself. It operates at the intersection of forensic pathology, material science, and art history.
Because you're dealing with objects that are over 100 years old, made entirely of organic materials that have lived wildly different lives. Let's drill down into that. Let's take the Ka toe print, that Tegleg Somdej we discussed earlier. The archives state this is used as a primary reference standard for authenticators. What exactly are they looking at through their jeweler's loops?
Well, let's start with what they are not looking at. The most common trap for novices, and the sources are incredibly explicit about this, is color. Color is an absolute liar when it comes to authenticating a century-old organic amulet.
Wait, if the color can change completely, how do you even begin to authenticate it? If I look at a textbook and the authentic amulet is a pale, chalky white, and someone tries to sell me a dark, oily brown one, my instinct is to immediately call it a fake.
And that instinct would cause you to miss out on a genuine masterpiece.
Really?
You have to understand how organic materials interact with their environment over a century. Imagine two identical 1920 amulets pressed on the exact same day. One is given to a rice farmer. The farmer wears it around his neck on a simple string against his bare skin, sweating in the tropical sun for 40 years. The organic pollens in the Muan Sarn will absorb the sweat, the body oils, and the humidity, turning the amulet a deep, dark, shiny brown with smooth edges.
And the second amulet?
The second amulet is given to a wealthy merchant in Bangkok who immediately puts it in a dry tin box on a high shelf in his house, where it sits untouched in the dark for a century. That amulet will remain pale, dry, and chalky with sharp edges.
Wow.
They look like completely different objects, but both are 100% authentic.
Okay, so if color is a liar, how do collectors prevent confirmation bias? If I'm wiring $2,000 for an amulet, my brain is going to try to convince me it's real, even if it looks weird. What is the undeniable metric?
The metric is structural integrity and internal consistency. If you can't trust the color, you trust the architecture.
Okay, the architecture.
The authenticator looks at the precise proportions of the Ka toe mold. They measure the exact width of the Buddha's head relative to the torso. They analyze the specific angle of the table leg base. The original carved wooden or stone mold had incredibly specific tool marks and structural lines. Even if the surface color changes, the way the dense clay compressed into the deepest recesses of that mold remains structurally stable.
So they are looking at the foundational skeleton of the piece.
Yes. And the most crucial part of this forensic analysis isn't even the front of the amulet, it's the back. The authenticators perform a rigorous 360-degree check, focusing heavily on the reverse side.
The flat back. Why is the back more important than the intricate carving on the front?
Because the back is where the human interaction happened. When Luang Fu to press the wet clay into the mold, he used his thumb or a flat tool to compress it from the back. That leaves specific identifiable compression marks.
Ah, I see.
Furthermore, as the organic Muan Sarn the pollens, the banana paste binder, the chalks dries and ages over decades, it shrinks. It creates microscopic fissures, drying patterns, and a natural patina.
And a forger can't fake 100 years of organic shrinkage.
Exactly. A forger can cast a perfect silicone mold of the front, but they cannot replicate the deep, internal tension of century-old shrinking organic matter.
Yeah.
Authenticators look at the edges to see how the material separated from the mold. They look at the distribution of wear. Natural wear, like from our rice farmer, will polish the high relief points of the amulet, but leave the recessed valleys rough and porous.
Makes sense.
A fake amulet that has been artificially tumbled or sanded to look old will have uniform, unnatural wear across all surfaces.
It really is like authenticating a vintage Rolex by opening the case back and examining the microscopic tooling marks on the gears, rather than just looking at the dial.
That is the exact level of scrutiny. No two genuine amulets are absolutely identical because molds wear down over a production run and environments alter the organics. But a genuine piece will always possess internal harmony. The aging of the material will logically match the wear on the structural lines.
This grueling, obsessive, almost pathological level of authentication is what gives the modern market its incredible confidence, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
When, you know, with absolute forensic certainty that you are holding an object made by the hands of this specific master, the financial value just skyrockets, which leads us into his later editions, the ones that have achieved absolute legendary blue chip status globally.
Yeah, by the time we reach the late 1970s, between 2520 and 2523 BE, the archives read like a catalog of masterpieces. This is the era of the Pitta Maha Lap Jumbo 1 and 2.
We should clarify the Pitta imagery, actually. This is fundamentally different from the Samdej. The Pitta features a rotund Buddha figure with his hands raised, physically covering his eyes.
Right. It symbolizes a deliberate withdrawal from outward sensory distractions, ignoring the visual chaos of the world to focus entirely on inward meditative stillness.
And the material composition of these late-era Pitta editions is staggering. They use nuegasorn, which is dominated by flower pollen powders, and balin, which is made from the burnt ash of ancient sacred palm leaf scriptures.
Think about that.
Imagine grinding up ancient sacred books and mixing the ash into the clay. The historical weight of the material itself is immense, and the archives mention a process called chanamantra.
Chanamantra means soaking in holy water. Some of these specific Pitta amulets were submerged in basins of holy water for 3 entire years while Luang Fu to continuously bless them daily.
3 years?
Yes. The water alters the texture of the clay, creating a highly prized, unique surface patina.
3 years of continuous daily blessing on a single batch of amulets. It's no wonder the modern market reality for these objects is just wild. Let me read you some of the listings directly from the source archive.
Yeah, let's hear them.
The Prapidta Plodni, which beautifully translates to the debt-free edition. It features silver talk roots, which are tiny, magically inscribed scrolls rolled up and physically embedded into the clay base. The listing offers it encased in solid gold, accompanied by a massive A4-size certificate of authenticity with free FedEx shipping worldwide. And the price is $2,499.
And crucially, what does the inventory status say?
Out of stock. Almost all of them say out of stock. There's a Pitta Maha Lap Jumbo 2 featuring gold tuck roots, listed for $2,199. Sold out. They even have metallic coins called Rian, made of Tongdeng, which is copper, or Nuyanoran, solid silver. These go for hundreds, sometimes thousands of dollars, and they are entirely sold out.
It's incredible.
This is a highly liquid, incredibly aggressive global market.
And if we step back, take a breath, and look at this entire picture, we hit the ultimate philosophical contradiction.
We really do.
We have spent an hour discussing a Buddhist monk who dedicated his entire existence to non-attachment. A man who took vows of poverty, who slipped in terrifying jungles to extinguish his own ego, and who actively turned away from material wealth. And yet, the direct result of that ascetic life is a hyper-capitalist frenzy over the physical objects he left behind.
It is the ultimate irony, isn't it? Luang Fu Tu literally gave away his ego. He gave away all worldly desires. He embraced the dirt of the forest. And in return, the world decided that the very dust he touched was more valuable than a diamond.
It seems ironic on the surface. But if you truly understand the perspective of the devoted collector, there is a profound beauty to it. The historical texts are incredibly clear on this point. Long before the wealthy collectors showed up with their jeweler's loops and Swiss bank accounts, this monk was revered by the poorest villagers simply because of his flawless conduct. The objects are, and always have been, secondary to the man himself.
The amulet is merely a vessel.
Exactly. For a true devotee, wiring $2,000 or $3,000 for a Plodni amulet isn't about buying a magical lottery ticket. It is about securing a tangible, physical link to an exemplary human life.
Right.
When a modern person living a stressful, chaotic, digitally overloaded life wears that amulet, it sits heavily on their chest. The weight of the gold and the clay is a constant physical reminder to cultivate discipline, to maintain humility, and to practice compassion. They are investing heavily in a daily reminder of what a human being is actually capable of achieving spiritually.
Wow. Let's bring this all together. We have taken an incredible journey today. We started in Ban Klong Beng Noi, watching an orphan boy with no safety net take shelter in a local temple. We watched him rise to shoulder the crushing administrative and spiritual burden of becoming an abbot at 206.
Yeah.
We saw him balance the terrifying malarial isolation of the Tudong forest with the endless demands of a bustling Bangkok community, eventually earning the reverence of Thai royalty.
We examine the evolution of devotion, moving from simple photographic lockets to the intense alchemical science of the 13 Pim in 1920. We decoded the microscopic DNA of the Muansarn sacred powders, the pollens, the scripture ash, the grueling Ponglob chalk-making process of the Wat Plab masters.
And we explored the forensic obsession of modern collectors studying shrinkage patterns and compression marks to authenticate a table egg mold.
It's been a deep dive.
We've seen how a life committed to absolute poverty generated a legacy of incalculable global value. Luang Fu To's life was preserved in clay, in ash, and in pollen, and it is now fiercely treasured across the globe. Which leaves me with a thought that I want you, our listener, to take with you today.
What's that?
The devoted followers of Wat Purdue Chimpli preserved Luang Fu To's memory because his life was a living, breathing example of unwavering virtue. Every action he took, every hardship he endured in the forest was an ingredient in the Muansarn of his ultimate legacy. So as you go about your week in our modern era, an era defined by digital impermanence, fleeting social media posts, and mass manufactured everything, ask yourself, what physical objects will be left behind to tell the story of your character a century from now? And if someone were to put the Muansarn of your life, your daily actions, your hidden disciplines, your unseen impact on others, under a magnifying glass 100 years from today, what kind of legacy would they find?